Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is us now beginning the afternoon session. My name is Janet Stewart. I think I was introduced earlier on as being in the German department, the visual culture department. I have research interests in cultural aspects of energy. I sit on the University of Aberdeen's Energy Steering Committee representing energy society and culture. I have an unenviable task, which is to chair a session following a session that Terry Brotherston has chaired. I will not be able to live up to that, the standard of chairing that he provides, but let me attempt nevertheless. So this session is on global responsibilities. And the idea with this session has been to try to bring together the kind of three sets of issues we've been talking about so far: profits, workforce and environment, but with a focus on the UK and Scotland's global responsibilities. And I was reflecting on discussions over the last couple of days. We heard this morning, for example, from Val, a particular situation where working with marine operators who apply UK regulations in all of the different jurisdictions within which they actually operate is an example of best practice. I've been reflecting on the question of the relationship between best practice and just straightforward good practice. Should we be aiming for good practice across the board rather than highlighting simply best practice as one question there? The emphasis in this session is on responsibilities. We're thinking, however, about the relationship that Jake alluded to first thing this morning between liabilities on the one hand and responsibilities on the other. So this relationship and sometimes a tension, of course, between legal liabilities on the one hand and then on the other hand moral responsibilities. We've been hearing some other examples this morning. I was thinking about Helga's examples about the activities of Norwegian unions in other jurisdictions and the kind of positive examples of collaborative work internationally that we can point to here. And we also, in this session, we want to think about the responsibilities of all of the different actors who've come together to construct what we might call the kind of energy environment or the energy assemblage. We're thinking about the responsibilities of individuals. We're thinking about the ways in which these responsibilities are configured from oil workers to managers to others. We're also thinking about the responsibilities of institutions and the responsibilities of the companies, the responsibilities of the unions, the responsibilities of government, and also, because we're here at the University of Aberdeen, as Terry alluded to earlier on, the responsibility of the universities. You know, today, the University of Aberdeen is providing the space in which we can have this kind of frank and free exchange of ideas and an exchange of concerns, an exchange of experiences. But the University of Aberdeen, of course, is also an actor, as all universities are, an actor in this kind of global energy environment. So what are the responsibilities of the university itself will also be up for debate. I'm not going to say anything more about that at the moment. I'm simply going to introduce now our first speaker today. Our first speaker is James Downey. James Downey is a partner at Stronix LLP. He's a graduate of the University of Aberdeen. He is dual qualified in Scots and English law. He's listed as a recommended oil and gas lawyer by the Legal 500. He acts for a number of upstream oil and gas companies and was a contributor to a number of publications, the Technical and Legal Guide to the UK Continental Shelf and the three-volume The Technical and Legal Guide to Global Hydrocarbons. And he's also a member of the Oil and Gas Legal Issues Forum Decommissioning Workgroup, so cuts across some of the questions that we've been discussing over the last couple of days. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I've been asked to provide a brief introduction to the legal framework governing the global responsibility of the UK oil and gas industry. So what a great task, 15, 20 minutes to cover that topic. It's an absolutely huge topic, and today, I mean, there's a number of things we could cover off. We could cover off transparency issues. We could look at the Transparency Directive and the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. We could look at sanctions. There's a variety of things we could look at. In the context of this short presentation today, though, I'm going to stick to a couple of important issues facing business and individuals. And I'm going to explain to you very shortly why I've selected these two topics. Global responsibilities can be interpreted as the responsibilities which exist towards those in overseas jurisdictions by virtue of UK law. And sometimes UK law implements international obligations which we have. It could also be interpreted as obligations which we owe in those overseas jurisdictions as a result of the law that applies in that overseas country where we're carrying out operations. And it's these areas I'm going to focus on today. I'm not going to focus on moral issues, very important as they are. I'm not going to look at those moral obligations that we might have towards people in other jurisdictions or to the environment in those jurisdictions in which we're operating. I'm going to take a legal approach and leave the moral issues to others today. I'm going to focus on areas where there are potential obligations which could be faced by companies and individuals in respect of their operations overseas. To the extent that there are legal obligations owed to people, there are obviously corresponding responsibilities, and it's those legal responsibilities that I'm going to focus on. I'm going to look at two examples today, and I'll explain why I've chosen those. The first one is, I'm going to look at UK attempts to tackle bribery and corruption, and that's an example of UK legislation which has worldwide reach. It's UK legislation, but there's the potential for people to be found guilty of that offence, even if a bribery offence is committed in another country. I've chosen this example as a result of a breach, even if that's overseas. It could result in 10 years in prison for individuals and an unlimited fine for an unwary company. The second example I'm going to go through today is I'm going to look at situations where there have been attempts to hold companies responsible or indirectly responsible for acts and omissions of their group companies which have occurred either in the UK or overseas. Where these relate to overseas jurisdictions, the attempts are normally based on the law of the country where those actions have taken place. And I've chosen this example because recent attempts to raise actions against parent companies have shown that it might not be safe to assume that if you use an overseas subsidiary, you would be able to ring-fence legal risk in that subsidiary. Okay, everyone accepts that you can't, there are publicity risks and PR risks involved, but a lot of people don't realise that legal risk perhaps cannot be isolated as they might think it can be. So let's start with the UK legislation with overseas reach. And the example that I'm using today is the Bribery Act. Now, it's probably fair to say that for many years, a lot of businesses, whether in the oil industry or in other industries, have had in place codes of conduct for ethical behaviour, policies relating to health, safety and protection of the environment, both in respect of their UK operations and in respect of overseas operations. And the oil and gas industry is no exception when we're looking at this issue. It's fair to say, however, that there's currently an international trend towards greater transparency and greater accountability in all businesses. Now, you may try to implement your policies overseas, but there can be societal and political and environmental issues there which make it difficult to do so. Let's look at the Bribery Act in particular. The UK now has in place, on paper, one of the most robust statutory regimes in the world aimed at tackling bribery, both in the UK and overseas. The key piece of legislation is the Bribery Act 2010, that came into force in July 2011, and in part that was introduced to give effect to one of our international obligations, and that was an obligation under the OECD Convention on Combating Bribery and Corruption of Foreign Public Officials in International Business Transactions. It covers bribery in both the public and the private sectors, both in the UK and abroad. Now, we need to very briefly look at the offences that are created in that Act, and there are four, so bear with me, I'll try and be brief. The first offence is a general offence of offering, promising or giving a bribe. Now, if we put that in a practical scenario, let's say that we've got an employee of a company, and the company, because I'm an egotist, is called Downey Limited, and that employee goes out and offers somebody £10,000 in the hope that they'll award a contract to Downey Limited, that company. In that scenario, the employee who offered that bribe would be guilty of the offence. The second example, the second offence under the Act, is the offence of requesting, agreeing, or receiving or accepting a bribe in exchange for doing something inappropriately. And an example here would be when I say to you that I'll award a contract to your company, Downey Limited, if you make a payment of £10,000 to my wife. And I, the person who's asked you for that, would be guilty of the offence of bribery. Requesting a bribe. The third offence, and this is the OECD one that the Act is supposed to give effect to, relates to bribing a foreign public official. And the offence here, if we use an example, would be I'm Downey Limited, I've got an employee overseas, and they have been tasked with trying to get a licence from a government. That employee makes an offer, or they pay some cash to the foreign official, and the hope of the employee in that action is that they will influence the decision of that public official. In those circumstances, again, my poor employee is guilty of the offence of bribing a foreign public official. So, all well and good, we've seen two out of those three examples. We've seen the employee who's in the firing line, they have done the bribery, they are guilty of the offence. So in those examples, these Downey Limited examples I've given you, is it possible that Downey Limited could be found guilty of offences of bribery? Well, the answer to that is yes, potentially, but under UK law, it's difficult to prove criminal liability of a corporation in the case of criminal actions that require a mental or intention element. It could be possible to find Downey Limited guilty of the offence or bribery offences if we can show that the directing mind and will of the organisation was behind the act of bribery. And that's called the identification principle, generally in UK law. Can we find the directing mind and will of the organisation, for example, as a member of the board, a managing director, or another senior official of Downey Limited involved in the act of bribery? Were they involved in asking for this to be done? So in the UK, there are difficulties in finding corporates liable for the actions of employees. It can be particularly problematic, kind of perversely, in the scenario where we've got a large organisation where the potential act of bribery could be occurring low down the chain in that organisation, and there's a huge gap in the structure between the managers and the directors of that company and the people on the ground who are doing things. The result is that it's sometimes easier to find small companies guilty of offences than larger ones. And this in itself might be one of the main reasons for the fourth offence under this Act. And the fourth offence under the Bribery Act is the offence of failing to prevent bribery. And that's known as the corporate offence. It's a bit of a misnomer, but it's generally known as the corporate offence. And under this offence, a relevant commercial organisation will be guilty of an offence of bribery if a person that's associated with it basically bribes a third party to get a business advantage for that organisation. And that's a strict liability offence. There's no intention on the part of the organisation. It's enough that an act of bribery occurs, and the intention of the person who does that bribing is to get a business advantage for the organisation. The very fact of it happening is the offence. The only defence that that organisation would have at that point is to show that it had adequate procedures in place to prevent bribery, that they had taken steps to prevent people carrying out bribery on behalf of the company. The important thing from today's perspective, as far as the Bribery Act is concerned, is the territorial reach. Any act of bribery that's carried out by anyone within the UK can be prosecuted in the UK. But that's not the end of the story. If you are somebody who's a British citizen, if you're closely connected with the UK, you're a British citizen or any other person, such as a UK registered company, you could be prosecuted for your actions overseas. So the act of bribery could occur in a different jurisdiction, but if you've got a close connection, you could be prosecuted in the UK. So for example, British citizen overseas bribes a person in that jurisdiction, the citizen can be prosecuted in the UK under the Bribery Act, even though the bribery didn't occur in the UK. A second example is if a UK company commits bribery overseas, then it can be prosecuted for an offence under the Bribery Act. The territorial reach of the corporate offence, this failure to prevent bribery, is even wider, and it is more encompassing than the other offences. Basically, this corporate offence of failing to commit bribery applies to any UK incorporated entity or any other overseas entity that carries on business or part of a business in the UK. So if you're a UK entity or an entity which carries out business in the UK and somebody overseas who's one of your associated persons commits an act of bribery, then even if that act of bribery has nothing to do with the UK, you could be prosecuted, the company could be prosecuted in the UK for failure to have complied with that section. Let's have another example. We've got a company, Company X, which is a US company. It's registered in the US. It's carrying on business in the UK. It's got an office there and carrying out some business. It wants to obtain a license in a developing country, and it engages an agent there to carry out the negotiation. The agent, unbeknown to this US entity, goes off and bribes the public official to try and influence them to grant the license to the American company. That company could be found guilty of the offence, the Section 7 offence, even though they didn't know that the bribery was occurring. And the only defence they would have, the defence they would have, would be to say that, well, look, we had adequate procedures in place to try and prevent this from happening. The penalties for breach, I mentioned at the outset that this has got overseas reach. If there's an act of bribery, the maximum penalty on indictment is 10 years in prison. And for a company, it's an unlimited fine. So you could face an unlimited fine for the actions of somebody else overseas, unless you've got adequate procedures in place. A few points, other points are worthy of note, that if you're found guilty of one of these offences, you might be debarred from public procurement exercises. It's likely that there could be orders under the Proceeds of Crime Act to try and recover sums that you've received as a result of the bribery. And of course, there's a huge reputational damage that could result from being found guilty, and sometimes even being investigated for potential acts of bribery. There are some points worthy of highlighting. There's no exemption in respect of facilitation payments. Now, facilitation payments are normally small payments that are made to government officials to try and smooth some function, to get them to do something more smoothly or quicker. And that raises the question of whether the Bribery Act is actually wider than the legislation in some other jurisdictions. For example, under the Foreign and Corrupt Practices Act, facilitation payments are allowed. One of the directors of the Serious Fraud Office in 2010 gave an example of two companies that wanted to, or a hypothetical example of two companies that wanted to build a factory in a developing country. One of the things that needed to be done was for some services to be connected to it. They could both be told that it will take 4 months to connect these services unless a payment is made, a facilitation payment. The Bribery Act, strictly speaking, would catch a payment made by the UK company, whereas the Foreign and Corrupt Practices Act wouldn't criminalise the payment to that official, this facilitation payment. So that's the first example today, global responsibilities. We can have global responsibilities in respect of what we do overseas by virtue of domestic criminal law that has got a reach out with our borders. The second example I'm going to use today is I'm going to look at the aspect of whether a company can be held liable for the action of its subsidiaries, and that will be whether it's in the UK or overseas. Many, many organisations are structured on the basis that we've got an operating subsidiary on the ground that carries out the day-to-day operations, and there's parent companies further up in the chain who are responsible for providing input on policy. They give guidance on what should be being done, and in addition to that, there are some organisations that have got a more hands-on approach and are involved in day-to-day management within their subsidiaries. There have been recent attempts to argue that the parent should be liable as a result of what has happened in other jurisdiction, where the parent isn't really trading on its own, it's trading through a subsidiary. And this is done through looking at the domestic law of that jurisdiction. A little bit of a very basic legal lesson on corporate liability, corporate structures, but it's a basic principle of UK company law that the acts and responsibilities of a company are its own acts and responsibilities, and not those of their shareholders. And that's been decided in case law about 116 years ago. It follows that if we've got a group structure in place where one company, the parent company, owns all the shares of another company, the subsidiary that sits beneath it, then strictly speaking, the actions of the subsidiary are its own actions and the parent shouldn't be held liable for them. And that is part of planning and risk management in most businesses, that you can ring-fence legal risk within a subsidiary and therefore insulate the rest of the group. There are some exceptions and there are some scenarios where a court can look behind the legal structure. One example is lifting the corporate veil, where basically the court can say, well, let's just disregard the whole fact that you've got a subsidiary. In reality, this is you who's doing this. And the courts are very loath to lift the corporate veil and look behind that corporate structure. There has been a case recently, though, in England, and that was heard last year, the case of Chandler against Cape PLC, where a parent company was found to be liable to the employees of one of its subsidiaries. So we've got holding company here, we've got subsidiary company here. This subsidiary has various employees, and one of the employees develops asbestosis as a result of employment with that company about 14 or 50 years before. Now, the court decided that the parent company was responsible. They had a duty of care towards that employee, even though that employee wasn't their own employee. We could look at this and say this is an example of a situation where the court is saying, let's just disregard this legal structure and just treat it as if the parent was the employer, but that's not what the court did. What the court did was said that in these particular circumstances, notwithstanding this wasn't your employee, in effect it was a third party, we have decided that you owed a direct duty of care to that employee to look after their well-being. You had a responsibility in respect of their of HSE towards them. The damage to that employee was foreseeable. The employer or the parent company could have foreseen that they may have suffered from asbestosis as a result of exposure to asbestos. The particular quirky bit of this case was that the parent actually employed world-renowned experts in asbestosis, and for that reason, and they had hands-on control of some things that were happening within that subsidiary, for that reason the court decided that there was a direct liability owed by the company to the employees of its subsidiary. Now, you may be saying, what's this got to do with international obligations? What it's got to do with international obligations is that the ruling has got relevance beyond potentially an employee situation. It could possibly be relevant in circumstances where there are oil companies where the parent company has got an involvement in HSE or environmental policy on respect of bribery or corruption in a subsidiary, and in theory it could apply worldwide. It doesn't necessarily have to apply just in respect of the UK. A very interesting example of a case which is based on the law of Nigeria is the case of Akpan against Royal Dutch Shell. And in that case, it was a case in the Netherlands District Court, a major Shell and its overseas subsidiary, Nigerian subsidiary, were sued for damages in the Netherlands as a result of oil spills that had taken place in Nigeria. Now, the action was raised by a Nigerian national and by Friends of the Earth in the Netherlands. The Dutch court, importantly, the Dutch court accepted jurisdiction and said, well, we've got jurisdiction in respect of Shell International. We've also got jurisdiction in respect of this subsidiary in the Netherlands, notwithstanding that the damage occurred in the Netherlands and these acts occurred in the Netherlands. And that was a particular aspect of Dutch private international law, which I'm no expert in, I can assure you, which meant that the cases could be held in the same court. Despite the fact that the case was held in the Netherlands, the procedural rules meant that the court had to consider Nigerian law when it was deciding on the case. And quite fortuitously, Nigerian law is based on English law. It's a common law system. In this case, the oil spill hadn't been caused by a deterioration in the oil well. There was a Christmas tree there, and what appears to have happened, and the evidence that the court accepted, was that third parties, unknown third parties, had sabotaged it. They had opened up the wellhead, and there had been a spillage. The evidence suggested that the spill could have been stopped a lot sooner if it hadn't been for people who'd blocked access to the site. And the evidence also suggested that once the spill had been stopped, there was an efficient cleanup operation took place. As I said, Nigerian law governed this claim. There were many grounds of claim, and all the claims against the parent company were found to be unsuccessful. They were all kicked out of court. And the rationale that the court gave for that was that the Cape case, which was considered in this one, related to a scenario where there were the employees of a subsidiary in the same country and a close operational link between the parent company and those employees, which the court found to be completely different from a scenario where you have a parent company in one jurisdiction and they've got a subsidiary in another one where third parties potentially suffer loss as a result of something that happens there. They decided that it was too remote, the relationship between Shell in the Netherlands and the Nigerian nationals. The court did find that the subsidiary owed a duty of care to a person who had control of ground round about the wellhead, and that duty of care had been a duty to make sure that the well was secure and was secured against sabotage. And that was the first time, there had never been an example in Nigeria of a scenario where a court had decided there was any liability as a result of a spillage caused by sabotage. In fact, last week, Friends of the Earth International announced that they were appealing the case, so we need to keep our eyes open on the outcome there. There are a few points worth noting. The first one is the Dutch District Court accepted jurisdiction in respect to the foreign subsidiary, and it was willing to consider the case, notwithstanding that all of the damage had occurred in Nigeria. The court made a comment that there appeared to be an international trend in trying to hold parent companies responsible in their home jurisdictions for damage related to occurrences related to their foreign subsidiaries. And the case is really a reminder that when you're deciding where you're going to be carrying out your operations, it's not enough to look at the law of the jurisdiction where you're incorporated or where your main base is. You've got to look at what the national laws are in the country where you're going to operate and decide what potential liabilities you could face in those jurisdictions. So hopefully these two examples will give you a feel for the fact that UK law can sometimes impact on overseas operations, UK criminal law, and the fact that overseas jurisdictions, will govern your operations there, and it is possible that you could be found liable in your home jurisdiction in respect to things that happen overseas. It might no longer be possible to ring fence overseas legal risk in overseas subsidiaries.
I should have said at the outset that we're deviating slightly from the format in this particular session in that James has spoken first specifically about the legal framework, so we're going to invite some questions now on those particular questions. We'll then move on to the next two speakers who are going to speak about corporate social responsibility from different perspectives. We'll then open up for discussion on those papers, and then finally we'll have Tom Greatrix up to talk about the UK government responsibilities, and after that the plan is that we'll have the panel members, all four of them, up on stage again as we've done in other sessions, and that they'll all be available for further discussion. I should also say that Terry's system of asking people to indicate with their lights who would like to talk played havoc with the AV technology. So we're returning back to the system of waving to attract my attention if you have a question. So we have one, two, okay, so we'll start up here and then we'll come down here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, I'm Mark Strachan, I'm a master's student here at Aberdeen. I have a couple of questions regarding the talk you just given, which was very interesting. The first section on the Bribery Act itself, is there a minimum limit, and that sounds stupid, but if a bottle of whiskey changes hands, is that still classed as bribery?
It depends what you're trying to do. I mean, the bottom line on it is that the Bribery Act is not supposed to catch genuine corporate hospitality, corporate gift giving. So there would be an analysis of what you were giving it for. But the magnitude of the gift is one aspect. It would be so de minimis that nobody would ever bother about it.
And the other question on the same point is, if there's an allegation of wrongdoing in a foreign country, we've discussed Nigeria or another country like that, if there's a prosecution in Nigeria for it, would it be prosecuted again here, effectively double jeopardy?
Well, it could be, because you're, the, the law in other country is it relates to that country, but there's a specific UK offence of bribery. So it's a UK individual who's prosecuted in Nigeria, but could still, in theory, be a prosecution in the UK. The fact, there's two things we need to keep in mind here. One is that it's one thing to establish that a crime or the facts that relate, that constitute a crime, have been committed. Another one is to look at, well, once you've established that, the prosecutors in the UK would actually look at whether it's in the public interest for prosecution to occur. So it may well be that there's been a prosecution overseas and say, well, let's not do it in the UK because there's been a punishment. But strictly speaking, yes, if there's been the crime, there could be the prosecution.
For that case, you quoted the Royal Dutch Shell. So Shell could be prosecuted in Nigeria and in Holland.
Well, it's important to keep in mind Shell weren't prosecuted. It wasn't a criminal case. It was a civil law case where the argument was that since the law of Nigeria was based on English common law, they hooked on to that Chandler case of last year, which was the first English case that had determined that a parent company could be liable for injury to an employee of a subsidiary. And they argued that for that basis, on that basis, there was a potential claim against Shell in the Netherlands. Now, Shell in the Netherlands argued that, well, this is really an abusive process because you don't have any realistic chance of finding against Shell in the Netherlands. Interestingly, the court in The Hague said, well, no, there's this Chandler case that suggests that a parent can sometimes be responsible for injury to third parties that have resulted from subsidiary operations. Therefore, it's not an abusive process to raise this case. And from a PR perspective, that's just fantastic for Ferenc de Haan in the Netherlands, who will obviously say, well, let's go for this. Not necessarily because the jurisdiction or the court process in Nigeria is slow, which it undoubtedly is, but because there's a huge PR boost can be given to the particular issue by raising the action in the Hague.
Thank you very much.
Two questions. First one, could you just tell us a little bit about comparing with US legislation, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Mm-hmm. What are sort of the key differences? And I mean, we have almost 40 years of track record of that act. I mean, how do you evaluate sort of the experience and the value of the act in the US? And the second question is around supply chains. Mm-hmm. Because undoubtedly, we have very complex situations in the oil industry where you hire a lot of subcontractors and a lot of your work doesn't get done actually by your subsidiary. So what does it mean, the sentence carries out business in the UK? I mean, you could have a subcontractor who doesn't have an office in the UK, so no physical presence, even though you know, you're a major client for him and so forth. Where does it stop? Where's the boundary? And the same with what does parent company mean?
Okay.
Because, I mean, let's take Shell as an example. In Nigeria, the main venture is only 30% owned by Shell International. Mm-hmm. So do you then look at, I don't know, majority-minority ownership, or do you also look at things like operatorship and so forth?
Well, there's three questions there. So if I look at the Bribery Act ones first, the ones that you mentioned about what's a parent, for example. What is a parent is largely irrelevant for the purposes of the Bribery Act, the Section 7 offence, because the Section 7 offence will hold you guilty if an associated person carries out an act of bribery, trying to get an advantage for you. Now, an associated person is any person who provides services for you. So a subsidiary, 100% subsidiary, could be an associated person, but as could somebody who's got absolutely no relationship with you other than a contractual relationship, such as a subcontractor. So that would be that example. As far as the logistical structure, the subcontracting arrangements are concerned, this is a very interesting point because, as you rightly say, you may have an operator who grants a contract to somebody, say, for example, it's to construct a platform for them. It's undoubtedly the case that your main contractor will not be carrying out all of this work. There could be another 20 contractors, subcontractors beneath that level, who are carrying out work for the original subcontractor. Now, the question then arises about how much should you do to protect corruption at the level of your subcontractors And the answer there is that in most cases, there are some quirky scenarios that are set out in government guidelines. In most scenarios, it would be adequate for you to put in your contracts, to have your own procedures in place, anti-bribery and corruption procedures, to make those known to your main contractor, and to provide contractual provisions in your arrangements with them, to the effect that if they subcontract any of the work, that they ensure that they get protection, which is no less, gives them no less protection than the protection that you got from them. So you're directly, you put your contractual arrangements in place with your contractor, and then you ask them or you require them to get adequate protection. You could also carry out due diligence. You could look at your principal contractor and say, well, what are your arrangements? And that would all be taken into consideration in deciding whether to prosecute you if a subcontractor was guilty of a bribery offence. Your last question was differences between, if I can remember correctly, differences between the FCPA and the Bribery Act. Now, as you rightly say, the FCPA has been on the go for a long time. The Department of Justice have got a good track record of prosecuting people. The Department of Justice have got the power to enter into deferred prosecution agreements, in terms of which, if you come to them and you say, well, look, hands up, we've done X, Y, or Z, it's possible for them to basically agree a deal with you. In the UK, under the Bribery Act, currently there's no deferred prosecution scenario. So if you go and you say, look, I've done something, that would be taken into account by a prosecutor in deciding what they're going to do, but they don't have any right to do a deferred prosecution deal with you. Now, the FCPA is focused at public officials, and bribery of public officials, which is extremely widely interpreted from the US perspective. From the UK scenario, the Bribery Act would prevent bribery in both a public and a private scenario. So if we were in negotiations and we're both private companies and there's no government entity involved in this, and I say, look, I will give you pounds X in a brown envelope if you give that contract to me, then that would be caught by the Bribery Act, but it's not something that under the FCPA would automatically be caught if you're not a public official. So it's on paper, it's a very, very strict UK regime. What we've got to keep in mind is that it's fine having things on paper, like it is having a contract that says X, Y, or Z. What we have to look at is, in practice, what are the resources of the investigating authorities here? With budgets being cut, and actually one example is that one of the authorities have had their budget cut from £50 million to £30 million at a time when the Bribery Act has been brought into place, how can you say that there will be an effective enforcement of that legislation in an environment where there are cost curbs? Does that answer your question? Your three questions.
Oh, thank you. We've got two more questions at the moment from the floor, three more questions from the floor. I'll take all three at the moment. We'll keep the questions short, the answers relatively short, and then we'll move on. That would be great. So we've got one, two, Sam at the back, and then three.
Adam Morgan, I've got a sort of mean Machiavellian kind of question, but I'll try and keep it brief. You're talking about you applying UK law to crime, to essentially bribery and crimes and stuff, which occurs in other countries. My question is basically why does the UK government give a damn? Because presumably, to an extent, bribery can sort of oil the cogs, make business run smoother to an extent, and that would presumably increase revenue to a company like Shell, who will then pay more taxes to the UK government. So why does it matter to the UK government that bribery occurs in countries like Angola and Nigeria? Why do we mind about that?
Well, we're kind of going on to the moral argument rather than a legal argument. But the moral argument is let's lead from the front. The OECD convention says that we will have provisions in place that say we're not going to bribe public officials. It also has got aspirational things in it about we're going to try and phase out facilitation payments, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. The British government's view, as I take it as well, from a moral standing, why should there be bribery and corruption in these jurisdictions? If we look at the guidance that was issued by the Secretary of State in respect of what constitutes an adequate procedure for the purposes of the Section 7 offence, there's a great flowery bit at the start of it, and sorry, I'm going to sound as though I've got no morals whatsoever, but there's a flowery bit at the start of it that says that bribery is a horrible thing, right enough it is, that bribery stifles competition, and the guidance was largely aimed at business and trying to prevent a situation where a bit of adequate procedures in place, but it was very much portrayed as though this will encourage competition overseas because you're not ruling out somebody who's unfairly prejudiced as a result of somebody else carrying out an act of bribery. Now, your Machiavellian view there is probably a right view that, okay, you can say that you stifle competition if you have bribery, but if you're the only country that effectively is trying to stamp bribery and having strict rules, then aren't you distorting competition or to competition by having regulations in place? Now, it's a moral position. That's the answer to your question.
Hi, I'm Chief Moy from IOT.
Hi.
Interesting talk, James. I'm coming from the opposite end of the scales around liability, if you like. We're seeing an increasing number of workers being compelled to take limited company status in the offshore environment and indeed abroad. Are there implications for liability going down the way for these workers who invariably have to have employer liability insurance provisions in place to provide these services?
In what sense, Pat?
In the event that they're involved in an accident and are blamed for causing an accident, for example, you talked about the Christmas tree, undoing a ball on a Christmas tree and causing a major event with multiple fatalities. Is there a potential for the liability to be shifted on to those individual workers as self-employed people?
I don't know what, it will depend on the contracting regime, obviously, but I think in a lot of these contracts, there is an acknowledgement that if you're a one-man band, that you will receive indemnification in respect of some of the risks, which it would be inappropriate or uneconomic for you to have to insure against. And I think that's probably about as far as I can go without having a specific example.
Would it be the same abroad? If that's the guy, I've got workers, members who are working in Africa, they're self-employed. If there was some suggestion that they were liable.
Yeah. Well, the question of whether they're liable or not would be a question governed by the law of the jurisdiction where they're based, which means there's not a UK-based answer that can be given, unfortunately.
And then, final question.
Hi, I'm Alexandra. I have a question in relation to the companies that can be liable. If, for example, the subcontractor isn't a subcontractor, but a company in which the UK registered company is it, or one of its affiliates is a shareholder, could the UK registered company still be liable for bribery?
Okay, so sorry, your example is you've got a UK company that's got a subsidiary.
No, that or one of the subsidiaries, but in your case, you're saying about a subcontractor, you're saying about a company in which the UK registered company is a shareholder.
Okay, the UK registered company is a shareholder of another company. That there are examples of where that company could be liable. The first one would be, if it was a subsidiary, for example, the parent company could be found liable for the acts of the subsidiary if, in fact, the subsidiary was being very closely controlled by the holding company. That's one example. The second example is the subsidiary company would be an associated party for the purposes of Section 7. Therefore, if it is supplying any kind of service for the parent company, then the parent company could be found liable for failing to prevent bribery and corruption, if there is corruption and bribery within that subsidiary.
And what about the case that the UK registered company is a creditor of the company that bribes?
It's a creditor? It doesn't matter. If it's bribery, it's bribery. It doesn't matter who the target is.
So it would still be liable, although it has an influence, but not exactly control.
I'm sorry, I'm not getting the...
Sorry, apologies.
No, it's okay.
If, like my case is, sometimes in the industry companies just go bankrupt or
yes.
have very big debts. It happens. Let's say that a UK registered company buys a debt, becomes a creditor of that company.
Mm-hmm.
And the company, because they're obviously in some countries that are very, very corrupt, the only way of doing business is by bribing.
Mm-hmm.
That's reality. In that case, could the UK registered company still be liable for the actions of the other company?
The company who bought the debt from?
Yes.
No, the only scenario in which it would be responsible would be who had actually bought that company. So, not its assets or its liabilities, but the actual shares in that company. So, if we've got, you've got a company and I buy it from you, and historically there was an act of bribery within your organisation, that would be something that could tarnish me. But I wouldn't have had an opportunity at that point to have had any adequate procedures in place. If I've got adequate procedures in place at the time I acquired your interest, that would be one thing. The problem we would have is that if you had committed an act of bribery and you were fined and you had an unlimited fine, at the time I acquired you, I'm now the shareholder in that company and I've suffered a loss as a result of you having to pay that fine.
But I'm probably the base of that
If I'm the new owner, and this bribery occurred at a time when I wasn't the owner, I could still be liable if I then acquired the shares in your company. And that's why if you're carrying an acquisition, you've got to be very careful of carrying due diligence on what might have happened in an organisation prior to your acquiring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we'll just thank you very much, James, for that contribution. So,